Welcome to What Matters Now, the Times of Israel's weekly podcast diving into one issue affecting Israel and the Jewish world right now. I'm your host, Amanda Borshel-Dan, here with our senior analyst, Chaviv Retegur. Chaviv, thank you so much for joining me today, October 7th.
It's good to be here, Amanda.
It's good to have you. And we are going to have a talking about the state of Israel 2 years into this war. We are, of course, at a crossroads as we are speaking, Chaviv and I. Others are speaking in Sharm el-Sheikh, Hamas, Israel, mediated by a team of Arab countries, Muslim countries, and the United States. And we don't know what is going to happen. Are we going to hear of a peace deal this week? We just don't know. So we are going to discuss what is happening to Israel, to Israelis, 2 years into this war, all of this and more when we're back. And we're back. I am Amanda Borshel-Dan here with our senior analyst, Chaviv Retegur. Chaviv, how are you feeling today, October 7th?
It's always a rough anniversary. I happened to talk to Eli Sharabi today, the hostage who got out back in the February exchange and lost his wife, two daughters, and brother, and didn't know about it for 491 days when he was inside and found out about it when he got out. And he has a book, the first book written by a hostage, and we were talking about his book. And one of the things he said really kind of struck me as God knows, you know, nobody experienced that day the way Eli Sharabi experienced that day. But those who were not at ground zero, so to speak, of the actual massacre, you still remember. You remember those hours of the morning where the slow revelation of the scale of it all. Nobody knew anything. The information was trickling out, and some of the things seemed totally unbelievable. So they were probably crazy. It was some kind of big terror attack. And I still remember it. And because I have friends who were so deeply affected by it, I have friends who died in the army, in the war that followed. It's something that doesn't go away. You know, they're all, the way Eli Sharabi put it is, he almost dismissed the anniversary, because what is a memorial day when you just see, you know, his family in front of him all the time? And so it doesn't mean much for it to be a specific memorial day. I think we're still very much in the new world that October 7 inaugurated, because Hamas took a great gamble. And the great gamble was that the desire to rid the world of this grain of sand in the shoe, of this constant irritant, a Jewish state on what was supposed to be Muslim land, or Jewish nationalism in a world that you know, in an ideological world in the West, of certain parts of the West, that there shouldn't be nationalism. Suddenly Israel's this thing called an ethno-state, a term never really used on anyone else ever in history. It's basically just a term unique to Israel in its actual usage, and there's like research on that. So it's just this gamble that if they can start that pivotal moment, that final war, that we will discover that the Jews are actually hated and that there's a vast array of enemies that want to come for them. That is how it turned out, and that is the new world that Israelis face. And we can get into it, talking about that in a thousand different ways. I mean, the Gaza war itself is obviously a very terrible war and is a part of the engine of that, a major part of the engine of that. But, you know, there are more painful, more large, higher death toll, mass starvation, genocidal wars underway at this moment that nobody on earth talks about. And so that gamble that the Jews are at the center of these grand visions of the world and they're the problem, and therefore Islam will come to their rescue and come to their aid, and therefore the great war for redemption will begin, that gamble paid off. And so the Jews are now living, in a sense, in a whole new world, and they don't yet know how to deal with it. And in that sense, the small story of an individual like Eli Sharabi is also who suddenly finds himself having to rebuild in a very visceral and very immediate way, losing his two daughters. But in that sense that we are in a new world where we have to reconfigure and rebuild and re-understand what's happening to us, I think is all of us. I think it's the whole nation.
I think you're right. And 2 years is a long time, but it's really a blink at the same time. And the first thought I was struck by this morning when I woke up is how very much in the same position I am, meaning I was in my bed and our seventh child was in the bed with us. Don't worry, all the six others did not climb in bed, but this little guy, he's so cute. He's 4 years old and he climbed into bed as he usually does every single night. And I woke up serving as his, you know, tailor-made pillow. And it was just the same as 2 years before when I'd woken up to the sound of alerts going off from the Times of Israel, the sound that something really terrible was happening. And just like on that day, I woke up to an alert this morning, and it was an alert stating that rocket fire was again being thrust upon Israel in the south. Israel is still under rocket fire from Gaza. It's as if we're living the same day over and over and over and over, but very different iterations of it in some ways. Do you have that feeling as well, Habib?
In some ways, I think the meaning of everything has changed. A lot of the sort of day-to-day is similar, but everything means something different. For one thing, how should I put this? For me, the last 2 years have been a kind of return to fundamental things. In other words, we thought, okay, that our enemies were deterred, but also that they were very dangerous. We discovered that we were, in a very important sense, wrong on both. Our enemies were totally undeterred and itching for war. And every single rocket in South Lebanon was put there for use, and every single weapon that Iranians developed in proxy, they developed, they meant to use. We discovered that in war, and we didn't know this, we weren't sure this, we're not the generation of the great wars of the past that were astonishingly successful and you know, of solidarity. We're a generation of modern internet and TikTok in a very wealthy country with a GDP per capita higher than France. And are we still capable of defending each other? We found out we're still capable of defending each other. We found out that our enemies are actually phenomenally, catastrophically incompetent and unable to actually stand up to us in a real war, a war where we plan and they plan and then we check what we've all been managed to build. We found out, I mean, we're basically the only massively successful country in this region that isn't just awash with oil and gas, that's actually successful for its own internal cohesion and competence. We found out that our enemies will go to endless self-destructive, never mind destructive of us. They want to commit a genocide against us, but they also are self-destructive toward their societies. And that's not something we thought. We thought they were so. On almost every fundamental question, can we defend ourselves? Are we actually united when the chips are down? Are our enemies dangerous and capable of destroying us? Will they go to self-destructive, catastrophic wars to do so? All these questions are now answered. And to me, I feel like, yes, it was a terrible awakening, but it was an awakening about dangers that were there. I just didn't know about them. And so I'm safer now knowing about them, knowing that the Iranian regime will use every, knowing that Hamas is willing to destroy Gaza on the altar of destroying Israel, that you have to have a larger explanation. You know, a Hamas that bombed every peace process isn't doing this because of occupation. I feel like I understand my world better now than I did before. By the way, also in the negative stuff, I mean, we found out our politicians, even in this two-year crisis, even at this scale, will still posture, will still divide us, will still only, you know, talk to the base, will still damage the country and hurt the country terribly on the international stage if it helps them win on in some specific tiny little shred of the right-wing base. We learned that too. And so we learned so much. And reality, I think, is so much clearer now, to me at least, that maybe that's the legacy of these 2 years. Everything's different.
Everything is different, but everything is kind of, at least to me, moving into the same direction that it was prior to the war. Of course, if you put your mind back to it, during the big outbursts of the judicial overhaul and the protest, it really felt, at least to me and to many others, that the Israeli public was on the verge of not civil war, but definitely some kind of existential tear. And the numbers are showing that we're edging back into that realm, meaning, yeah, Israel did unite immediately after October 7th, and there was a great feeling of togetherness for, I don't know, one could say even perhaps a year, maybe less. But now, at least according to polling that I shared with you as well, through the Agam Labs in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, this is research led by Nimrod Nir and Dr. Gael Talshir. These are pollsters that we've been following, you and I, Chaviv, over the past 2 years, and we've referred to their numbers here and there throughout these past 2 years. And they recently put out another poll sampling 2,170 Jewish Israelis and 459 Arab Israelis. This is a poll that was conducted this month. And they talk about, for example, when we're talking about, you know, the togetherness, the cohesion, the main threat that these two pollsters are finding is that there is 61% who see internal polarization as a greater danger than external enemies right now. So that is basically the same atmosphere that we had during the judicial overhaul outburst. This is prior to October 7th and arguably one of the factors that led to October 7th. So Chaviv, how do you feel about this number, this 61% that sees internal polarization as a greater danger than external enemies?
People living outside of Israel or who don't know Hebrew and don't follow the Israeli press in Hebrew, I don't know that they understand what we're talking about. The moment the war came, 77% in this poll in 2023, said that the war united society. And in 2025, the same poll found that 66%, down from 77, but not just down from 77, flipped, that the war had actually divided society. In other words, it went from, a quarter, less than a quarter, who thought it divided, to two-thirds who thought it divided. And what they're talking about, meaning deep, deep into the right, we're not talking just about opposition party voters. What they're talking about is that there was this silence for a couple of months after October 7th. And then, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months in, on the government, in the coalition, the politics began to reassert itself. As soon as they thought they could get away with it, it was back. Netanyahu's campaign to survive the next election came back. Channel 14 started talking about which parts of Israeli society weren't serving, about the secular, right? They have a coalition with the ultra-Orthodox who don't serve, or 95% don't serve. And they had to explain that and justify that. And the way they did it was to start these campaigns against the secular center-left. But the secular center-left was in massive numbers in Gaza and serves in above 80%, depending on which town you look at the data, above 80% draft rates. And so they had to begin on Channel 14, that's this very pro-Netanyahu kind of modeled on Fox News, literally. And so these campaigns came back, and we discovered just how much we have a political leadership that nothing will faze them. And they will campaign on the divides. They will campaign on the divides, and they'll do it, you know, forever. And that's totally separate from, you know, I think that on the question of taking Philadelphia, when Netanyahu was arguing with Gallant, people won't remember this, but a year ago, whatever, Netanyahu, I think, was right. And on a couple of different times when there were hostage releases, you know, at stake, and the center left said one thing, and Netanyahu said, I was with Netanyahu. But Netanyahu also went repeatedly, months at a time, without speaking to the Israeli public. I've been complaining for the last couple of months, including with you on this podcast, that Netanyahu doesn't have an English language spokesperson. There's the information war was completely abandoned by this government. This government has a minister of heritage and a minister of diaspora and a minister of public diplomacy, who, because war started, resigned, which is an astonishing thing to know about this. So the level of, it's not just incompetence. These are talented people. The Minister of Public Diplomacy is one of the loudest, most obnoxious, and most toxic members of Knesset of Likud. And what's strange about that is that she used to be one of the most sensitive and thoughtful novelists of the Israeli literary scene. And so there's something about our political system, something about our political culture. It's easy to blame Netanyahu. I don't know if Netanyahu is the product or the perpetrator. Is he just literally the product that the system itself produces? But we cannot do politics except as bitter, angry, vicious partisanship. We simply don't know how to do that anymore. And yes, more Israelis think that's a threat than literally everything else. The world hates us, not as big a threat. Iran's nuclear program, not as big a threat. Nothing threatens us as much as that, say almost two-thirds of Israelis in this poll. And the war divided us is now the consensus view of the Israeli public on left and right, in a way that is the opposite of what they thought 2 years ago. They thought that the war actually united us. We did see that massive unity. But to learn that even this emergency, even this war, did not change our political culture, didn't change the set of interests. Maybe, you know, maybe it's just folly and human failing and they're just awful people. I don't know. But then there's still a systemic question of how do we keep elevating these awful people? I suspect that they're not awful people. I suspect that there is a system, a web of interests, a web of how you become a member of Knesset, how you become a cabinet minister, how you stay prime minister. Our system is built to make predatory partisan politics useful and successful, and to elevate it and to create this kind of political class. So yes, it's the great weakness of Israel. It is our Achilles heel. It was before the war and the judicial reform, and it remains so now. And we have shattered the Iranian nuclear program with a miraculously competent air force that should not be able to exist on this earth. And we can't figure out the simplest things domestically in our domestic politics.
Let's go to a short break.
On October 7, I was here at the Nova Music Festival. I ran for my life, hid for 7 hours. Terrorists shot me twice. Thankfully, I survived. I'm still dealing with trauma. And I'm not alone. 3 million Israelis are in trauma. They need mental health care or physical rehabilitation. Wounded soldiers, families, and scared children.
Since 1912, Hadassah has been a life-changing force in Israel. Today, Hadassah has 2 world-renowned hospitals, pioneers breakthrough medical research, cares for youth, and has built the much-needed and largest rehabilitation facility in Jerusalem.
Thank you to everyone at Hadassah Hospitals. You've been helping me and so many others. And a special thanks to one nurse, my mom. I love you.
And we're back. I'm Amir Borsal-Dan here with our senior analyst, Chaviv Retigur. Now, Chaviv, one of the things that has always boggled my mind and many other people's minds is how well Israel generally does in terms of the happiness meter, meaning every single year we've been in the top 10, at least in the decades, I believe, that it's been tracking happiness and contentment throughout the world. But at least according to this poll that we've been discussing right now, low morale, negative sentiment, and economic strain are causing rising pessimism, meaning 48% are pessimistic versus 34% optimistic. And this is a sharp decline even from 2024. Fewer than 1 in 4 believe their children will have better lives, and most are unsure or doubtful. One of Israel's superpowers, I think, has always been the Israeli sense of purpose. And part of that purpose has been to provide for the next generation. So what do you see here happening, Chaviv?
So first of all, if we take a comparative look, Israelis are extraordinarily happy compared to Westerners, most Westerners. And I still believe that, and I still trust that data because, first of all, it's a whole methodology and people can really dig into it and do some research. There's a lot of things that Israelis do right, literally every day of the week. I mean, just the healthcare system is one of the best. We live years longer than the average American or Brit. It literally just our life expectancy. There's some things, basic things that we do right. But the main thing we do right is a thing unavailable to most Western societies because it's the conservative Middle Eastern half of us. I mean, talking about the Jews here, which is that we have large, tight-knit families that get together constantly because there are way too many Jewish holidays. And these are some of the, and therefore we also have family as backup and we have family as part of the whole system. And so These are things that are dissolving in the West, measurably, constantly, and deeply. I mean, most Westerners no longer live in communities that they have any idea or know who their neighbors are in their apartment building. Most Israelis do. And so these are just basic mechanisms of solidarity that we have. So we are as liberal as you want to be. You can be a married gay couple with kids and speaker of the Knesset from a conservative party. That is how liberal Israel is. And also, you can live a very deeply, you know, I don't know what, my wife is the oldest of 8 kids. So we have been over these holidays and her parents, you know, a dozen times. So it's just constant.
8 is just, Chaviv, way too many.
8 is too much. Eight is too much. 7 is reasonable.
7, that's okay.
So I believe it. I think that the pessimism is very specific. And I think it's very affected by very specific. I'll give you an example. I said to you that people who don't follow the Hebrew might not understand what we're talking about. In this very poll, in this Hebrew University poll, there was one little line that we probably all both read past, but I'm coming back to it now because it's the fundamental point. They asked if the cabinet, the political leadership, the cabinet is the security, it's the, I don't know what, 8 ministers, I think it is, who decide on war and peace. It includes the heads of all the major parties of the coalition. They asked if the cabinet acts mainly on political motives or miktsui, which means professional, but in other words, or substantive issue, or they make their decisions on war, on peace, on fundamental policy, on substantive grounds. 58% said the cabinet's main motive is political. And only 15% said it was substantive. And then they asked, they drilled down into coalition voters, voters of the 5 coalition parties, Likud, Religious Zionism, Otzma Yehudit, Shas, and United Torah Judaism. And among them, cabinet acting on the substantive, for substantive reasons when it makes its decisions, was only 1/3. 2/3 did not say that, of coalition voters. Long story short, the Israelis genuinely believe they are led by people not doing the work. That is a belief that is a majority belief on the right, on the voters of this coalition. And that is a profound source. If you face a world with real dangers, with, you know, it's not that the world disagrees with us on Gaza or even is horrified in Gaza. Nobody marches in Holland for anything ever. Okay, the Americans, you say to them, why are you so obsessed with Gaza and not Sudan? And they say to you, we fund your army. The Dutch don't fund our army. The French don't fund our army. Why is every country in the West marching? And so to find yourself in the dock, to find this global debate about whether you deserve to exist that has sort of leapfrogged out of the Muslim world into the West and through academia, through a lot of this progressive anti-colonialist kind of ideology, all of this stuff doesn't make Israelis pessimistic. But the idea that their own leadership is pathetic, is incompetent, is not actually meeting the challenge. The prime minister has no English language spokesman. There's no other information war of any kind. Now we found out that the Israeli government incompetently tried to hire some firm in the United States to produce, you know, viral. It's like boomers trying to write TikTok videos and not understanding why everything comes out stupid.
I don't think it's I think it essentially is. It's not.
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
But they can't even imagine that maybe the problem is deeper and simpler. What the hell is the goal of the war? Why hasn't Israel explained what the goal of the war is? You have a war in Gaza with thousands of dead kids. Now, if it's justified and legitimate, and this is the only way to get at Hamas in those tunnels, then it's still thousands of dead kids. And if it's unjustified and illegitimate and driven by Ben-Gvir's racism rather than deep strategy, then it's still thousands of, you can't get around the horrific cost to Gazan society. But you know what you can do? You can actually want a better day. You can say this is in World War II, the Allies shattered Germany, decimated Germany, wiped out cities, the strategic firebombing of cities. was part of the Allied war effort to break, because and why did they do it? Because the Nazis were so dug into that society, so deeply entrenched in that society, that there wasn't a whole, there weren't many other options for if you decided that the Nazis had to surrender, not just agree to a stalemate or a ceasefire, surrender. That's what needed to happen. But then the Allies planned and decided on a massive rebuilding. There would be a new day. There would be denazification and a new Germany built out of the ashes of the old, and the old had to die so that the new could be born. That's the story that Israel needed to tell about Gaza. That new day for Gaza legitimizes a terrible war to remove a Hamas that bombed every peace process and committed on October 7th. And last week, Ghazi Hamad on CNN said would commit more October 7ths. And today, on the second year anniversary of October 7th, said October 7th was a great success. Long story short, Hamas actually has to be defeated. And Gaza has to be rebuilt after denazification. And if the Israelis had been saying that, instead of empty Gaza, ethnic cleansing, and whatever the hell Ben-Gvir's been talking about for 2 years, then it would have been a whole different discourse. Israel hasn't lost its enemies in the West. It's lost just about every one of its friends in the West. And that, the friends, it didn't have to lose. And that's just government incompetence. The Hamas thinks the information war is the main war. Qatar and Al Jazeera think the information war is the main war. And Israel's not even present there. So I think Israelis feel like they are led by incompetent people. The Air Force pulled off that Iran war astonishingly. The cabinet? It pulled off the Iran war. The things that the actual leaders, Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Derry and the actual leadership actually had to make decisions about, namely Gaza, hasn't been brilliant. It's been profoundly incompetent and slow and hurtful and badly handled. And so I think that sense that they're not leading substantively, they're not leading, they're fighting through their politics, which is deep on the right, not just on the left. Is the source of most of the pessimism. Sorry, that was way too long. I apologize.
Totally not too long. Everyone's here to hear you, Khabib. They're sick of my faux Canadian accent. Don't worry about it. But everything you've been saying for this past monologue that you just had has really helped me understand one of the points of the survey that we've been talking about that I just didn't understand. I found it very, very confusing that the primary identity among Jews, the Jewish identity, dominates by 51%, followed by Israeli identity of 33%, meaning these Israeli Jews find that their Jewish identity is their primary identity. They're first a Jew and then second an Israeli. And it made me wonder if these Israeli Jews are ashamed to be Israeli, meaning they're trying to distance themselves from the Israeli label and are still embracing the Jewish identity. And maybe that's right, because the coalition voters emphasize the Jewish identity by 78%, and opposition voters emphasize their Israeli identity by 49%. I don't know. Do you see anything in these numbers that speaks to what I'm saying here, that perhaps some people are trying to distance themselves from being Israeli in this moment?
It's very interesting. That was a very interesting question. I have a very different sense of what they're responding to. And I wish they dug in so we would know more what they mean. I think it's part of this, drilling down to fundamental things. Israel isn't hated because it's Israeli, it's hated because it's Jewish. The Muslim Brotherhood ideology of a lot of the Islamist movements around us in the region, Hamas is, you know, core Muslim Brotherhood. The concern is that Israel is Jewish and not Muslim. If it was Israeli but Muslim, there would be no problem. There would be, by the way, no concern about occupation either. The concern is that it is Jewish. And the fact that the Jewishness of Israel is what puts it front and center is what makes ordinary, decent, good people around the world are responding to terrible images from a terrible war. But there's only one war they've ever seen images of in this way. There's only one war where the algorithms are shifted in this way. And it's not the worst war, and it's not the war with the most images of horrible victims of airstrikes. And it's not even the war with the West, the wars where the West did this, but they don't see those images. Western airstrikes and what happens and what the consequences. They only see this war. And so the ordinary decent people are radicalized by algorithms that are intentionally focused on the fact that it's Jews. And that sense that the entirety of the attention is because they're Jews, that sense that the problem the Muslim world has with Israel is that it isn't Muslim, it is Jews. In the end, you live or die as a Jew according to them. And so in the end, you live or die as a Jew according to the Jews as well. So there is a tilting back to a Jewishness that is suddenly fundamental. It's experienced as fundamental because A, the enemy, and B, also the solidarity. The Druze are in this war with us. A great many Bedouin are in this war with us. Hamas killed 50 Bedouin Muslims on October 7. But those are important stories. Those are part of the story, but they're nevertheless just number-wise marginal. The fundamental experience is that the Jews close ranks and go to a war and defeat their enemies, and that is the only safety there is to be had. And so that also increases, I think, that identification and affiliation with Jewishness. My sense is that those who say they're Israeli before being Jewish, first of all, may not be Jewish. In other words, I have to look at the data, but maybe that includes a lot of, for example, non-Jewish Russian-speaking relatives of Jews who made Aliyah with Jewish family members, but themselves aren't Jewish. It might also include Arabs, Muslims, Druze, various kinds. But the Jews among them, it's an expression of secularism in a government, in a country governed by a very religiously identified coalition. So there are other, so people mean different things when they use the words, but I think that they mean Jew as an ethnicity. And I think that this war really highlighted that sense of Jewish solidarity, because that's the thing under threat and under attack.
So Khabib, we are 2 years into this war. Of course, we're terribly depressed as a nation. It's not a surprise, but are you finding any glimmers of strength, any glimmers of hope, even 2 years on here?
Look, I'm the idiot who's constantly banging that drum of optimism, and nobody knows what I'm talking about. And then we talk for 10 minutes and then everyone agrees with me and they say, well, yeah, obviously, but it still feels bad. And I'm like, no, it does. It's awful, but still. Yes, we are incredibly strong, incredibly strong. The great Iran, remember Iran like 8 months ago? Remember what you thought Iran was? What do you think it is now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's talk about this for a second, because our former defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, has been banging the drum that Iran could be imminently striking again. So it's not off the radar entirely.
Yeah. And we can cause so much damage to them. We were so precise and gentle in the last war. And they know that. And if they push us to the wall and it's an existential threat, then Iran would look different. And we showed those capabilities. And we showed that the Iranians have no air force. We showed that the Iranians are penetrated by Israeli intelligence. I mean, thousands and thousands of people were rounded up. I'm going to take a dangerous gamble of guessing, okay? Luckily, I don't have to run any of these intelligence networks, and it doesn't matter if I'm wrong, that they rounded up just in panic. They did not actually round up all of the intelligence networks. Iran is a regime overseeing a people that doesn't like it, and they survive by oppression. And that's part of the incompetence of the regime. If Iran really wanted to be powerful enough to face Israel and destroy Israel, it should democratize, have free markets, have a real research and development, have self-correcting mechanisms, have a public critique of the government that constantly improves the government and keeps it honest. And then it would become the kind of competent state that can make use of its energy resources. It's one of the wealthiest countries in the world in energy, but it's still a poor country because it's incompetent and constantly picking a war with the whole entire world for its religious revolution. If they became a free, democratic, competent state, they would actually have the capacity to threaten us, but then they'd be a free democratic state. They wouldn't want to threaten us. No democracy has ever fought a war against another democracy. And so we're kind of protected by the fact that they're crazy, psychopathic dictators. And we discovered that gap between a democracy that thinks it's survival's at stake, and a, you know, crazy dictator with a world-conquering religious vision who can't string together a proper air force or a proper air defense or a proper, you know, counterintelligence system. We are so much more powerful than our enemies understood, and we are so much more powerful than we ever understood. And our strength comes from the democracy. It comes from the solidarity. It comes from the history of these people. We are a refugee people from 60 countries, from three continents that emptied out in the spasms of nationalism and the destruction of minorities that destroyed dozens and dozens of minorities, but nevertheless also destroyed the Jews across all these falling empires and over the course of the 20th century emptied out into Israel. That's who we are. We know that we have to stand our ground because we know we have no other option. And we are free enough and competent enough and self-critical enough to actually be competent at war. And so, yes, I, the generation of the Six-Day War, when they knew war was coming, when the Egyptians had placed a naval blockade on Israel, when it was very clear that that was happening, they dug 14,000 graves. They dug mass graves in Tel Aviv, in Yelkon Park in northern Tel Aviv, knowing that a war was coming that would be catastrophic potentially for Israel, and it wasn't clear that we would survive it. And that was the week before the Six-Day War, where we quadrupled in size and all the Arab armies melted before us. We are much, much stronger than they were. The gap between us and our enemies is bigger than it was in 67. And Hamas's strategy, it's really its last, kind of the last trick of our enemies. And this was also, by the way, Hezbollah's strategy, is to use that last leverage they have against us, because becoming a democracy that's competent at actually building out bureaucracies and war is not an option because they're not an ideology that can produce a democracy. So their last trick was the sacrifice of their own society. Hezbollah is willing to see Lebanon destroyed in the war to destroy Israel. Hamas is willing to see Gaza destroyed in the war to destroy Israel. Everyone keeps screaming it's a genocide, but Hamas is quietly, calmly negotiating. As if it's not a genocide, but just a war they're losing badly. But, you know, more dead Palestinians is an onus on Israel. It hurts Israel. So, you know, we can take our time. The destruction of their own polities as a leverage for the destruction of Israel signals the scale of the gap in strength, in competence between us. And if that doesn't make you optimistic for our fundamental future, by the way, it has always, Jews have always, the greatest danger Jews have usually faced, certainly in this land, was their own divide and not the enemies that come for them. That was a little bit an irresponsible thing. That's how the Jews tell the story. Obviously, the Roman Empire comes for you, you die. I mean, that's obviously the case. But what Chazal in the Talmud chose to remember from that was, in fact, the Jewish divide was what destroyed us and not the Roman Empire itself, was the lesson. I don't know if that would have worked against the Romans if we'd been united, but I do know that that lesson, I think, holds true today, certainly. We are so strong, and the only things that we need to fix that are real Achilles heels at an existential level are the divides within us, the things that we ourselves have to fix. And our leaders aren't going to do it, so it has to be everybody else.
I hear everything you're saying, and we could end the program here, and probably we should. So listeners, if you stop listening here, I don't blame you at all, but I'm still going to ask this question. I hear everything that you're saying, but I don't feel like we're very strong. Since the war has gone on for 2 years, and without this Trump plan, it doesn't seem like it will end very quickly, meaning if Hamas is just playing with us yet again at the negotiation table and in the end decides not to accept this Trump deal, the war will go on most likely for, it seems to me, another year. At least it will take time to finish with Gaza City. It will take time to move on to the other areas that the IDF is not fully in control of. So while we are very powerful, it doesn't feel like that on a very, you know, personal level, as we're still sending my children into Gaza, into this danger. It doesn't feel like we're very strong. What do you say to the mother of three soldiers in this aspect?
If Hamas decides to continue the war, which we don't expect it to, because it is actually desperate to prevent the complete destruction of the entire tunnel system in Gaza City, that it's its last great refuge. After that, there's basically the camps of Deir al-Balah, Nusayrat, etc. But that's it. That's the, there isn't a whole lot more of Gaza for it to have find sanctuary in. If it, however, decides to keep going, then it's one leverage over us. And the one reason this war lasts, I mean, look, we've talked for 2 years about this. Our critiques of this government's decisions and the war decisions, I think I've kind of been borne out. In other words, going slow, right? Slowing down because they were scared of Biden and Biden not sending the missiles. Well, great. Biden didn't send the missiles and took you 4 months to go into Rafah. And those 4 months where everything just kind of froze. Israel paid costs. Gazan civilians in those tent cities paid costs. And all Joe Biden managed to do was make everybody suffer more and delay the actual right conduct of the war. Whatever the result of the war is, a great peace agreement, a terrible destructive war of 2 years, let's do it fast. Let's get it over with. And there's dragging it out forever is massively costly to Israelis, massively costly to Palestinians, and basically only good for Hamas. And this government has dragged it out at every single possible turn. And that has been something that we have been, you know, droning on about constantly. And I think that that's basically been borne out by events, that critique. But the only reason Gaza has a chance against us in any way, that Hamas can do this kind of war, is their civilians, is the mass use at a strategic scale, a scale never used before in the history of warfare. That's what those 500 kilometers of tunnels are. No one has ever done that. 500 kilometers of tunnels are the single biggest bomb shelter system, the most comprehensive bomb shelter system ever built by any government in any war. And no Gazan civilian has been allowed to step foot into them. And that's the point. The directing of the entirety of Gaza's economy to the destruction of Gaza, to the protection of Hamas while Gaza dies. That's the purpose of the war. You can hate the Israelis with the deepest passion. That's still the purpose. In other words, what you hate the Israelis for is calling Hamas's bluff, is going into a war that Hamas built for Israel to go into. That's what you're hating Israel for. In other words, hold a small place in your heart to hate Hamas as well. That's all I'm saying. Now, that's their one leverage over us. And by the way, that is a powerful leverage. That's the only leverage that could possibly slow us down and stop us. And it's doing it. And while everybody's screaming genocide, the actual conduct of the war is the opposite. If there weren't civilians in the way, they'd be dead in 10 minutes, all of Hamas. And civilians in the way is the only thing stretching this out in this way. And Hamas knows it. And by the way, if they survive in Gaza because of it, every war that will ever be anywhere on this earth, okay, the PLO learned from the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong learned from the FLN of Algeria. Everybody's constantly learning from everybody else. Every war there will ever be a war on civilians explicitly and structured and built to be on civilians because it works. Hamas can't survive this. And the destruction of Gaza is a reason Hamas can't survive this. As much as everything else, as much as the debt that Hamas owes the Israelis and that the Israelis intend to exact. And then Israel has a cosmic responsibility to rebuild Gaza. And the fact that it won't say that until 10 minutes ago because Trump forced Bibi to say that has been 100% costs of it on Israel. Israel has had to pay vast costs for that folly of its own government, or callousness or cruelty, if you want to see it that way. I actually think it's literally just folly. I think it's incompetence. So yes, they have leverage over us that makes it feel like what? I mean, the weakest of our enemies. Hamas is by far the weakest of our enemies. Their military capacity is a fifth, and their missile arsenal is a tenth of what Hezbollah had. And Hezbollah was shattered in 2 weeks, and Hamas is still going. The simple answer is they put 2 million people in the way, and that slowed us down. And that's not so terrible that that's the one thing that can slow us down.
I think I do feel a little better, Khabib.
Told you.
And it did take about 10 minutes, actually. So, yeah, you're pretty accurate. All right, Khabib Oush, I've taken too much of your time on this Motzei Chag, this October 7th, which is a tough day for everyone. So thank you for spending a little bit of it with me.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to The Times of Israel's What Matters Now. Please check out another installment next week. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until next week, shalom.